ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. A little later, the story of a heroic Australian soldier, the war surgeon Weary Dunlop, who saved so many lives of prisoners working in appalling conditions on the Thai-Burma Railway. A new life has been written of this great man by Peter Fitzsimons, and he will be with us soon. But first, with the anniversary only days away, we thought it was time to check if the thinking that brought down Gough Whitlam 50 years ago is still alive in the Liberal Party. Have they any regrets about the dismissal, any second thoughts? Would they do it all over again? To answer for them, the Liberal Party nominated the former Shadow Attorney General, now Shadow Education Minister, Julian Leeser. Now, Julian cut his teeth working for John Howard on the No campaign that dashed Republican hopes in the referendum of 1999. Last year, he left Peter Dutton's shadow cabinet in order to campaign for The Voice. He is, of course, from way, way back, a lawyer. Julian, welcome to Late Night Live.
Great to be with you, David.
Julian, I was a rookie journalist when Kerr sacked Whitlam. Where were you on the day?
I suspect, in my mother's tummy. It's about 6 months before I was born.
Yes, I did the maths, and I'm glad you said so. You were in vitro at the time. Nevertheless, 50 years down the track, you've had a good time to think about this. And what do the Liberals now think about the dismissal? Has the party any regrets? Do they stand with Kerr 100%? Where are they?
No, I don't think there are regrets. I think we do stand with the actions of our colleagues at that time, the Liberal opposition under Malcolm Fraser. We stand with Sir John Kerr, who did his duty, and with Sir Garfield Barwick, who provided advice to John Kerr in that regard. And the principle here that the framers created a constitution with co-equal houses, except in the fact that the Senate couldn't initiate a money bill or amend a money bill. And that means that the Australian Federation is different to other places. The basic principle is that a government that can't guarantee supply needs to offer its resignation and call for a general election. And that was the principle that Kerr was trying to get Whitlam to do. People forget now, they think blocking supply was such a one-off radical idea in 1975. The truth is the Labor Party in opposition, before Whitlam came to government, had sought to block supply on 170 occasions.
Blocking supply was a pretty standard political, or threatening to block supply, threatening. It's a pretty standard political tactic. And what's more, Lionel Murphy and Gough Whitlam both defended the tactic in the late 1960s. So no difference there. But shall we go through this step by step?
Sure.
Firstly, what does a politician in the House of Representatives need to form a government?
Well, you need to have the confidence of the House, which means effectively that you need to have a majority on the floor of the House, or if you can't have a majority from your own party, as you get occasionally in hung parliaments, you need to have some sort of arrangement with people on the crossbench or in a coalition of parties where they will agree to back you in a confidence motion. Because if you fail to win a confidence motion in the House of Representatives, that's another occasion where you need to go to the Governor-General and offer your resignation.
But you also, of course, need supply. You can't
you
govern
do.
Without supply.
You absolutely can't govern without supply. And that's that is true. I mean, and there are conventions in relation to this that go back to Britain. They go to some of the colonial parliaments and some of the state parliaments as well.
So if you have confidence and supply, you can govern.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Now, from about September, at least, of 1975, Sir John Kerr was getting worried because the notion of blocking supply was once again in the air. And he began to talk to a number of people about perhaps him having to intervene to resolve the issue. And he talked to the Prince of Wales at the independence celebrations in Port Moresby. He was corresponding with the Queen's private secretary. He was corresponding with the Queen's deputy private secretary. He was at various times in discussion with a number of his former colleagues in the law. And at various points, he was in discussion with the Chief Justice of Australia, Sir Garfield Barwick. But he was not talking to the Prime Minister. Now, what does the Liberal Party think of that these days?
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, he was talking to the Prime Minister and, you know, there were occasions where the Prime Minister had indicated at different times that, you know, there might be a situation, as he said in October 1975 at a state banquet held at Government House in honour of Tun Abdul Razak, the then Malaysian Prime Minister, that it might be a question of who got to the palace first. So Whitlam
was
well aware.
That was a joke, though, wasn't it? That was clearly delivered as a joke, and the people present laughed.
Well, that may be the case, but it at least indicates that Whitlam was well and truly aware of the range of options that Kerr might have. And at different times, Kerr sought advice, including trying to seek advice from the First Law Office, the Attorney General and the Solicitor General. He had advice that was presented to him by Bob Ellicott, who was a former Solicitor General of the Commonwealth. At that point, he was the Shadow Attorney General. And John Kerr himself, I think it's important to note, was himself a very, very distinguished Australian lawyer. Because he was a cautious person, I think he was, trying to take soundings for what could have been and ultimately was a very difficult decision.
And what's more, in many of those conversations, all the way up to November the 11th, Kerr was making it clear that fundamental to his thinking was the need to preserve his own job, that whatever he did had to be done in a way where his position was not challengeable. Now, what does the Liberal Party think of that as a basic strategy to solve a crisis?
Well, the Governor-General's role under Section 61 of the Constitution is to maintain the Constitution. And what does that mean? That, you know, he was effectively the umpire in relation to the policing of the conventions and to ensure that proper legal constitutional government was maintained. And I think he was concerned that, that he was able to exercise his functions properly in that regard. And ultimately, what was his function? What was the effect of the dismissal? The effect of the dismissal was letting Australians have their say, and they overwhelmingly backed his decision.
Oh, Julian, I'm trying to be so orderly here.
Sorry, David.
You know, so sort of step at a time. We'll get to that. Okay. Now, there's a huge political crisis going on. The Whitlam government is in the poo. There's no doubt whatever about that. It's very, very clear to Whitlam that if he goes to the same sort of a double dissolution election that he did in 1974, he'd be thumped. But there is something he can do, which is go to a half-Senate election. And because there had been some retirements in the Senate and some odd appointments by the Queensland and New South Wales governments, there were some appointments to Labor senators. One died, one retired. And they were replaced with really figures who weren't Labor figures. But that's now against the law, isn't it?
Well, you'll remember that. In 1977 there was a referendum. It's one of the very few successful referendum questions that were carried. And that dealt with how you replace Senate casual vacancies. And you have to replace somebody in the Senate casual vacancy from the same party.
So we don't even have to discuss that because it's been fixed by referendum. That's a blessing, isn't it?
That's right. I agree with that.
So there's this huge crisis going on, and Whitlam decides that he will go for a half-Senate election, which, on all calculations, will actually deliver him control of the Senate.
Well, David, I think that's a big leap of faith to say
maybe
that.
Maybe it is. But that was the danger, wasn't it, for Fraser? There was a real danger here that once you, for the first time, you had senators being elected in the ACT and the Northern Territory, and the two improperly replaced senators would now be properly elected, there was a strong chance, that Whitlam would get control of the Senate.
I'm not sure that was a calculation he made. I think he was playing a politics of brinkmanship, and he wanted to do everything he could to bring the government down, and that's why they went to the extent of blocking supply and, you know,
talking
and acting the way he did.
Talking about brinks, let's get there. At about noon on November the 11th, 1975, Whitlam, having determined that he wanted a half-Senate election, went around to see Kerr and presented him with that advice. Now, at that point, Kerr held no discussions with him, offered him no alternatives, simply handed him a piece of paper, sacking him. Now, this, in many ways, I think, looking back over those 50 years, becomes the absolute key point of this whole schmozzle. There was no discussion between Prime Minister and Governor-General, because the Governor-General is supposed, in constitutional terms, to advise and warn. He did neither of those things.
Well, I think you've short-circuited the conversation that happened there. I think Kerr asked Whitlam, from recollection, will you advise a double dissolution? Whitlam said no, he was there to advise a half-Senate election.
Yep.
And then Kerr said, well, you leave me with no choice, and gave him the papers. And then I think Whitlam looked around for a phone or something like that, and they shook hands, and Kerr said words to the effect, you know, we'll all have to live with ourselves then, or we'll have to live with this then.
Yeah,
I think that's something along the lines.
But Julian, the key thing here is that Kerr says, that leaves me with no alternative, because
that's right.
Not true, is it? Because there were several alternatives open to Kerr at that moment, and I would have thought the Liberal Party, looking to the way in which our constitution works, would now think that Kerr and Whitlam should have had a conversation, that at least Kerr could have said, look, if you are intending to stick with that advice, I'm going to have to sack you. Now, look, do you really want that to happen?
Well, David, by the same token, Gough Whitlam could have said to him, Look, what do I need to do? Why don't I advise you, therefore, of a double dissolution election? Instead, he left the building and went off and had a steak at the lodge.
Yes,
the
but
question,
Julian,
I understand the point
sacked.
You're getting at.
Had been sacked.
Well, he was given papers. He could have said to the Governor-General, look, if that is my only alternative, I advise a double dissolution election. If that was his alternative, he had every right to do that, but he chose not to. Now, the question that you're asking here, it's a really interesting one, because there were so many matters that, you know, if we were talking about this 10 years ago or 20 or 30 years ago, there'd be all sorts of issues of disagreement. But now it seems that this is really the only issue of disagreement. You know, to what extent should Kerr have warned Whitlam? And the reason I think that Kerr didn't give Whitlam a more extensive warning, as it were, was firstly that event with Tun Abdul Razak, because he felt that Whitlam was going to go to the palace and remove him because of the comments that Whitlam had made. You know, who will get to the palace first? Secondly, Whitlam had come in on the on that day, on the 11th of November, and advised a half-Senate election. That was his choice. He could have advised a double dissolution.
Yep.
Or he could have said as well, look, okay, I hear you, I will advise a double dissolution. But thirdly, I go back to the point I made earlier, that it's the Governor-General's job to maintain the constitution. And I think Kerr felt that it would be a dereliction of his duty for him to be sacked and put somebody else in that position.
Troy Bramston, who's written a new biography of Whitlam, has revealed in The Australian today that Malcolm Fraser drafted an obituary for Whitlam. And in that draft obituary, never delivered, Malcolm Fraser said there should have been more consideration and more conversation between Whitlam and Kerr. He acknowledged the failure of Kerr to warn as a weakness in the whole scheme.
Well, Malcolm Fraser has reflected on a whole range of issues subsequent to being Prime Minister, where he's come out of different views than those views that he had at the time of his Prime Ministership. So I'm not completely surprised to hear that.
But Julian, this is the central constitutional moment. This is the Prime Minister in the presence of the monarch. That's the key thing, isn't it? The conversation, there was none. Here's the letter, you're dismissed.
Well, I think you're putting a particular spin on it, David. I don't think that is a completely fair reading of that conversation. And as I said, it was open to Whitlam to advise a double dissolution election. And let's remember, what was the point of this? You had a situation where the Whitlam government could not govern because it could not get supply. It failed. Those bills had failed to pass the Senate. How did it get resolved? John Kerr sent for Malcolm Fraser because he could advise a double dissolution election. So ultimately, the Australian people could resolve this issue. And the usual conventions is if you cannot govern without supply. So if you can't get supply, you need to have a double dissolution and let the Australian people have their say. It was actually Kerr was the guardian of our democracy in this moment.
That is sweet angels and anthems in the background. Julian, as you know, supply had not run out. and the Prime Minister has the constitutional right to contest the squabble between him and the opposition all the way to the brink. And the supply had not run out. He had money.
Well, it was starting to run out already. There were his ministers and officials that were talking about in areas like housing that they weren't able to pay their public servants. The other thing was you were looking at the practical issue of when was the last date that you could possibly hold an election, and the Electoral Commission advised it was December 13. And as I say, in the counterfactual, there is no guarantee you would have got any relief, and based on what happened in the 1975 election, the Senate situation would have been worse for the government, and a new Senate wouldn't have convened at any rate until the following July.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Julian Lisa in the most calm and considered way about 50 years' reflection on the sacking and where the Liberal Party is today. And I think we now have more clarity on this, that the Liberal Party is not concerned that supply had not run out. The Liberal Party is not concerned that there was no real discussion between Kerr and Whitlam before Whitlam was sacked. And now, Julian, I want to ask you what happens after the sacking, whether the Liberal Party is concerned about the events later on that afternoon. Because Fraser accepted his caretaker assignment, so we know that Kerr was giving to somebody who did not have the numbers in the House of Representatives the job of being Prime Minister. Now, that's okay with you?
Yes, because Fraser had two roles. Pass the supply bills and advise a general election, a double dissolution election. And
okay,
that's exactly what he did.
So they were the roles he was given at 1:30. Now, at 2 o'clock, through some extraordinary schmozzle by the Labour Party, I'm not for a moment suggesting that the Labour Party handled this day particularly well, but through some schmozzle, supply was passed. Now, from 2 o'clock on November the 11th, money was no longer the problem. So then at 3:15... the House of Representatives passed a vote of no confidence in Malcolm Fraser. Now, you remember earlier in our conversation, you said the two things you need to rule, to govern in Australia, are confidence and supply. So at 3:15, Whitlam had confidence and supply.
But he was no longer the Prime Minister.
No, that's the point. That's right.
And Fraser, having lost the vote of confidence, had already advised a double dissolution election.
Yes, but the Speaker now makes his way out to Yarralumla to inform the Governor-General that Edward Gough Whitlam has the confidence of the House of Representatives, and it is the will of the House of Representatives that he be re-sworn as Prime Minister, and look, he's got all the money he needs for the next year. And at this point, the Governor-General refuses to see the Speaker. Now, is the Liberal Party happy with the Governor-General refusing to see the Speaker?
Well, in circumstances where the Australian people were going to already have their say because of the advice that the Governor-General had already got, yes.
That's very interesting. Now, of course, it was always open to Kerr, go back to his office for a second, it was always open to Kerr to say to Whitlam, you have to take the nation to a general election. It was always open. But the problem there for Kerr, of course, was that he feared he might lose his job if Whitlam stayed in office.
Well, I don't think that that's true.
Well, he has said
Because
Kerr has said
Whitlam could have advised taking the nation to a double dissolution election. Had he advised that when he first went to see Kerr on the 11th of November, he would have still been Prime Minister and he would have taken the country to a double dissolution election. That was the alternative for Whitlam
right
on that day.
Can you sort of reduce to a rule for future knowledge? Because this is a very important conversation, because this is about how Australia is governed. Now, can you reduce to a rule those occasions on which a Governor-General is entitled to refuse the advice of his Prime Minister?
Well, I think as somebody who was very involved in the Republic referendum, including a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and I've read much on these issues, broadly, you know, a Governor-General can exercise reserve powers, in other words, powers without advice, where a government where there's no Prime Minister, so, for instance, and in 1967 when Harold Holt drowned.
But that's not the situation here.
No,
he is refusing the advice of his Prime Minister. What's the rule there? When can that happen?
Well, when a Prime Minister fails to secure supply, or when a Prime Minister loses a vote of confidence, those are the occasions that he can refuse that advice. But what you're saying in relation to the afternoon events there, Fraser had already given the advice. And ultimately, the Governor-General's role is to ensure that the Australian people are the ultimate arbiters of these issues. And that's what he did.
Mm.
Fraser had given him the advice. It was one of only two conditions of his prime ministership. Pass the supply bills and send this matter to the people. And that's exactly what he did. And the people endorsed Kerr and Fraser.
They certainly did.
Overwhelmingly.
But, yeah, overwhelmingly. But Julian, this is a point of real importance. At 3:16, about an hour before Kerr's private secretary came to the steps of Parliament House to dissolve the House. At that time, a man other than Fraser had the confidence of the House of Representatives, and there was money. At that point, you are sacking a man who has all of the characteristics of lawful government, and the Liberal Party is not concerned about that.
But the only reason he was able to get supply was because Fraser was able to guarantee supply. That's the first point. And the second point, the only reason Fraser was Prime Minister was to ensure that the Governor-General had advice to call a general election to let the Australian people decide.
But that's a deal between the Governor-General and a politician.
To let the Australian people determine the outcome.
The Parliament has now said, Gough Whitlam is our leader and there was supply. So this is the Governor-General dismissing Whitlam for a second time, isn't it?
No, it's because the only reason that Fraser was made Prime Minister was because he could secure supply. It was Fraser who secured supply, not Whitlam. And it was Fraser who was the caretaker Prime Minister because it was his job to advise the double dissolution election, which he did.
But constitutionally, it doesn't matter who gets supply, does it? It's just supply. It's the money of the government. And it doesn't belong to Fraser, it doesn't belong to the Liberal Party, it belongs to whoever is governing.
It belongs to the Australian people, ultimately.
Ultimately.
And the idea was that Sir John Kerr wanted the Australian people to have their say on these matters, and that is in accordance with the convention, where a government that cannot secure supply, which the Whitlam government was not able to do, should resign and let the Australian people have their say.
Julian, the Whitlam government still had supply, the old supply, on November the 11th, 1975, and there were at least two Liberal Party senators in the upper house who were wavering on whether to push this thing over the brink. Whitlam had the right, did he not, to contest that to the edge of the brink, and the brink was not there yet. So is the Liberal Party happy for the Governor-General to intervene, as was the case here, before supply ran out, before the political process had reached its conclusion?
Yes, because part of the matters that Kerr had to take into account was the actual practicality of holding an election. And the first thing I would say is that, you know, this was November 11. They had to have an election on the 13th of December because it was the last practical date. You couldn't have had a summer where you had an election in the middle of the summer because you wouldn't have been able to staff the polling booths with AEC workers who are often school teachers and the like.
Julian, though, I love this point about the practical election. So this mighty constitutional crisis is in some way resolved because it would be a bit inconvenient to hold an election during summer. That's fine by the Liberal Party?
It's more than a bit inconvenient. We're talking about the democracy of the country here and how you can ensure that Australians are properly going to be able to resolve this crisis at a vote at the ballot box. I know some of Kerr's detractors and Whitlam's cheer squad like to think what Sir John Kerr did was a coup. A coup is the sort of thing you see in Fiji where people hang on to power for a long time without elections. What he did was to ensure the Constitution functioned as it was imagined by the framers, which was when a government was unable to get supply, that the issue was ultimately resolved by we the people.
So, 50 years down the track, the Liberal Party stands with Kerr.
Yes, we do.
Julian, thanks so much for talking to us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Coming up, the life and work of Weary Dunlop. Peter Fitzsimons and I are almost related for reasons he'll soon explain. I've known him for years because we worked together on the Sydney Morning Herald. At that time, he was just a simple sports commentator, hacking away in his little corner of the world, talking about mainly football. Then he started to write books, and they were mainly about football. He started writing about football, tried a couple of books on politics, and then found his subject, war. He's written a number of books about war and about magnificent people in war. Why is a subject I'm going to have to explore in a few minutes. Peter is also a campaigner, a leader of the Republican movement, a big voice now in the Australian press, and has been for ages. He joins me now to discuss his latest book, again, a book about war and a remarkable person, The Courageous Life of Weary Dunlop, surgeon, prisoner of war, life-saving leader, and legend of the Thai-Burma Railway. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
David Marr, thank you for having me. I could fill the half hour with great David Marr stories. Can I tell two very quickly?
Oh, Peter.
Well, I'll say this. I've come full circle because you had a huge influence on my first biography, which was on Nick Farr-Jones. I thought, who's the best-selling biographer at the moment? David Marr, Patrick White. So I read that and it infused my copy with David Marr, wonderfully evocative florid prose, totally perfect for Patrick White, hopeless for Nick Farr-Jones.
You got rid of it. Boy, have you scrubbed that.
I had to delouse the whole thing of David Marr. It occurred to me about a month ago, I had to go through paragraph after paragraph to take the David Marr flavour out of it.
Scrub it clean. And as a result, it was a great success. But would it have been a success, Peter, if you hadn't gone through that exercise of making it your own?
I'm hoping it still would have been a success. The other one I remember you fondly for is at the Sydney Morning Herald, where the fellow who wrote Barbarians at the Gate, I can't remember his name. What was his name?
Let's not remember his name.
Whatever it was, he wrote Barbarians at the Gate.
He was very unkind to all of us.
And he was on the next desk to you, and he would pick it up on a Monday morning and say, what? 110,000? What? 115,000? And there was David Marr just in the corner trying to control his disdain.
Well, of course, I've outsold him. Fitzsimons, gather yourself. Why is it that you love writing about war? You've not been to war.
My sister's view is because both mum and dad were served in the Second World War, that I grew up in a household that of World War II veterans who spoke so sort of respectfully about people like Weary Dunlop, about Nancy Wake. And the more I got into it, so my first big breakthrough book was Nancy Wake, Second World War, and Kokoda, which I never thought, you know, it just exploded. There was a hunger for what I say in speeches, you know, Australian stories told in the Australian vernacular about great Australians. I've done a lot on the Great War, First World War. The one that really resonates most with me is I did a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald last year that when the day comes for the Day of Remembrance, we Australians engage in respect, reverence, and remembrance. With the three R's, there's one R we're missing. We're missing rage. And I talk about things like the Battle of Fromelles, where 7,000 Australian soldiers were ordered by the Brits to charge at the Sugarloaf bunker 400 yards in broad daylight with no cover. The great General Melburnian Australian, Pompey Elliott, General Pompey Elliott, gets the officer, takes him to the spot and says, what will happen to my men if I give them these orders? And he says, I don't like to engage in that speculation. Well, I'm asking you, what will happen? He said, well, if you ask me, it'll be a bloody Holocaust. We'll get those orders changed. They weren't changed. 7,000 soldiers charged, 5,500 went down, 1,850 killed, not one yard of trench taken. So for me, that's like a forgotten story. Fromelles is a forgotten story that bloody well deserves to be known what happened.
Now, Peter, give us Weary Dunlop's life and career in about 100 words.
Okay.
That's all I allow you at this point.
Okay. Born in Wangaratta, raised around Benalla, was fiercely intelligent to the point that the teacher said at Benalla High School said to his father, "You've got to don't make him stay on the farm. He's got to study pharmacy, medicine, surgery, England, war." Finds himself on the Thai-Burma Railway as a lighthouse of moral clarity and courage against the barbaric Japanese, not the barbaric Japanese people, the culture that the Japanese people, barbaric culture that the Japanese were immersed in at the time, and was loved by his soldiers. At one point, when the Japanese captain gave an order to one of his soldiers to stick with a bayonet, to kill one of the patients, one of the POWs who'd lost two eyes, two arms, and one leg, and Weary stands in front and says, "Any bayonet that goes through this man will have to go through me first." And he was loved by the men for his courage, for standing up. And the story, there's so many stories out of it that I love, but you will have read the Tom Uren one. So go on.
I gave you only 100 words, Peter, and this is a disobedience. Disobedience at the ABC. What you have left out of that account is what clearly, profoundly interests you in Weary Dunlop. Mm. Can I get you to guess what it might be?
You know, I know you think I'm a rugby player that can type, but he was. I was briefly in the Wallabies, and I worked it out the other day. I reckon I was about 520 games of rugby to the good before somebody said you're good enough to play for the Wallabies.
And he was 16.
16th game he ever played, and he was so strong. He took it up at the age of 27 at the University of Melbourne. He was rooming with a Queenslander at Ormond College. He said you'd go well at rugby. He turns out for the fourth, the thirds, the seconds, the first combined University side, All Blacks. He was also a boxing blue. So when the brawl broke out against the All Blacks in the first Bledisloe Cup, 1931, this brawl broke out. Weary did the housekeeping, cleaned them all up. And they said to him at the end of it, one of the press said, "You know, how are you so strong?" He said, "Well, growing up on the farm at Benalla, then I was able to carry a bag of wheat under each arm, each one worth 210 pounds, each one weighing 210 pounds.
And a third."
He said, "Well, there's a bloke at home who can hold another one with his teeth."
Now look, Fitzsimons, I understand there are a couple of PhD students at work now on rugby in the work of Peter Fitzsimons, looking at it as the moral framework of all of your writing. And of course, the life of Weary Dunlop opens with a tackle, opens with him tackling.
Oof!
Yes. And what you get in Peter Fitzsimons' work is a lot of sound effects. Mm. Tell me about your approach as a writer, because it interests me very much, of the sound effects, of the barracking you do, and the deploring, but the barracking you do in your prose.
You and I'm not being mealy-mouthed. Obviously, you are an eloquent and beautiful writer. No, I'm not joking. You're obviously, beyond question, a beautiful writer. I take a different approach. What I came under the influence of an American writer by the name of Gary Smith, who writes for Sports Illustrated. He came to Australia in the year 2000. He was here for a year, and I used to read his stuff and think, why is his stuff so much better than my stuff? And he would explain it to me and explain it to me and explain it to me again. Use SSS, sights, sounds, smells, evoke time and place so that the reader is not at the campfire with the narrator when the narrator says, "It was a dark and stormy night." Describe the dark and stormy night. Put it in present tense. Put the reader in the moment and have so much FD, fine detail, that the reader actually feels like they are there as it is happening. So when I, going trawling through the diaries and my researches, I'm looking for dialogue that I can put a footnote to that puts the reader in the moment, the detail. So when Nancy Wake, she told me that the sound of a bullet going past your ear is the sound of a kitten meowing. Meow, meow. It's beautiful. When Mawson goes to Antarctica, if I say it was 40 degrees below zero, that's pretty bloody cold. But if I say it was so cold that the sailors on the ship loved it for the fact that because the captain said they had to be clean shaven, all they had to do was go out on deck in the morning, face the wind. In 30 seconds, their bristles would be so frozen, they rub their hand over their face. They're smooth as a baby's bottom. That's the kind of detail that I strain for. And in the scene on Mutiny on the Bounty, which I love, when Fletcher Christian at 5:03 a.m. pushes the door open with a cutlass and takes Captain Bligh up and ties his arms around the mizzen mast as the mutineers gather. And Captain Bligh says, "Mr. Christian, you have bounced my children on your knee, sir." And Fletcher Christian says, I know, I am in hell." I wouldn't have the brains to make that up, but it's there. And there's a footnote. And so what I love in nonfiction, when you are reading Great Expectations, the finest work in the English language, there is nevertheless, in this staggering story, a little voice which whispers to you, "This didn't happen.
It's all made up.
What I want in Shipwreck.
Don't.
No, in the Shipwreck of the Batavia, for example, when you're reading that, or the Catalpa Rescue, or Weary Dunlop, what I want is readers to be absorbed by the stuff, to be there in the moment and get a big voice which says, "I can't believe this happened. This is an extraordinary tale."
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking, as you can tell, to Peter Fitzsimons. Now, Peter, you say you had to be really persuaded to do this book, and it sure doesn't read like it.
The man that introduced you to me was Matthew Kelly.
Editor,
publisher, editor of Random House. And Matthew's been at me for 15 years to do Weary Dunlop. And I started once and I started twice. I just couldn't get into it. And about 2 years ago, I started and I looked at the detail. I started to, you know, really get into it. And as you know, the best of all possible things happens when you get gripped by the tale by the tale you're doing. And
you just have to
that happened.
It.
And so for me, if there's a theme, I mentioned Tom Uren. He was 21 years old. He was on the Tyburma Railway. And in his maiden speech, and great Tom Uren, who became Deputy Prime Minister, and I think he was a parliamentarian for 36 years, he, in his maiden speech in 59, says, "Everything I know about life, about politics, about the way to approach the world, I learnt from Weary Dunlop on the Tyburma Railway. We were on one side of the creek. The Brits were on the other. Weary Dunlop said, 'We're all Australians. We're going to look after each other. It officers will have exactly the same food as the men. We will divide everything up. We'll divide the work. We'll share medical care. The strong will look after the weak.' Tom Uren said, 'On the other side of the creek, the Brits marched in. All the officers got all the food, did none of the work, were in the big tents. And 600 of them marched in, 50 of them marched out.'" And the significance of that tale is in 1987, Tom Uren and Weary Dunlop go back to the Tyburma Railway to Hellfire Pass for the first time in 40-odd years. The only way Tom Uren can get up the steep hill to get to Hellfire Pass is putting his right hand on the left shoulder of his young Labor apparatchik from his office. His name was Anthony Albanese. And I talked to the Prime Minister about it. He says Tom Uren was the father I never had. Tom Uren says that Anthony Albanese was the son I never had. So there's a strange connection between, I guess, the politics of Anthony Albanese and what happened on the Tyburma Railway, even though I note that I suspect that Weary Dunlop never voted Labor in his life. He was a patrician in that sense.
He was first taken prisoner in Java and was imprisoned in Bandung for some time.
Very good pronunciation. I had to learn how to say that.
Bandung.
Bandung.
Don't you know there's a song, "Hello, Hello, Bandung"?
Oh, I don't know that.
I'll teach you the tune later, not now, on air. But there, I mean, in his way, he keeps meeting extraordinarily interesting people.
Yes.
And one of the people he meets there is a Dutchman called Laurens van der Post.
Yes, an extraordinary tale. That van der Post, he was hugely influential on Weary Dunlop and was the first one to suggest that line I've just told you about pooling everything and dividing equally. That was suggested by van der Post. And van der Post, according to what he told Weary, that he was a colonel, that he was a this, that he was a that, and he became hugely influential after the war, he was a huge mentor to Prince Charles, and all of these things
that and a great writer,
and all of these things he claimed to be. I think he died 95 or 96 and 98. It all came out. It was all an absolute fantasy. All he was a fluent liar, a hugely talented man, and a huge influence on Weary Dunlop. And but all of it nonsense. None of it actually true.
And it was there in Bandung that the Australian officers and men first approached a problem which I must say ambushed me, Peter. The notion that officers and soldiers would have different rations, that they would have, it's inconceivable to me. But the Australian troops actually divided on the issue, didn't they?
Yes.
Some of the officers were willing to share with their men, some weren't.
Weary had negotiated with the Japanese, and he had influence over the Japanese, and they couldn't just put a bayonet through his heart or whatever, because they were going to work these Australians to death, and they needed the doctors to keep them alive against all odds. And so Weary negotiated under the Geneva Convention, you've got to give us a small allowance every month. I think it was 5 shillings for officers, 1 shilling for soldiers. Weary gathers the officers in and says, right, we will pool all of our money in the one pot, and so we can buy eggs from the local villagers, we can get rice, buy pigs. Two of the officers said, we don't want to do that. Weary, a boxing blue, second row for the Wallabies, basically said, you're not listening to me. This is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. And that was the way it was done.
He and a large contingent of prisoners were then shipped to Singapore and found themselves in Changi Prison, which sounds like really a holiday home compared to what they'd been through, and they weren't welcome.
I was raised on the notion, and look, and there'll be many of your listeners who
are listening to you, Peter.
Well, but I was just, Changi was, you know, a notorious prison, and I think most of the Australians that got there thought it was absolutely shocking until they got to the Thai Burma Railway, at which point it looked like Club Med. And yes, there was a famous scene where the commanding officer of the Australians in Changi referred to the Java rabble, which was Weary and his men when they arrived, and at the opening dinner. Weary and his men get there at 4 o'clock in the morning. They are shattered with exhaustion, and they are summoned to the parade ground.
Ill-dressed,
hair grown. Weary wasn't fussed on saluting. He wasn't fussed on what they wore. He was fussed on keeping them alive. And they were referred to as the Java rabble. And this was the 8th Division, who many of them had fought very bravely, nevertheless were there. The Australians at Singapore, many of them had been fighting for 2 or 3 weeks, if that, when Singapore fell. And this commanding officer, the Australians, referred to them as the Java rabble, and Weary in his reply toast said, I have the honour of commanding men who have fought in Greece, in Crete, in Tobruk, across the Middle East, and we salute you, the Malay Harriers, I think he called them, which was, you know, the Malay Runners, which was very unkind, because some of those 8th Division fought like alley cats, but he made strong reply, and again, his men loved him for that.
And then they moved on to the Burma Railway. Now, Peter, the Burma Railway is a great subject of Australian writing, isn't it? Again and again, writers have addressed the railway.
Mm.
Let's begin by talking about the railway itself. What was it designed to do? Was it ever finished? And is it in use today?
It was mentioned. They wanted the Brits when they were in charge, the French when they were there. They all wanted to do it through the jungle for the previous 100 years. The Japanese decided we need to, pardon the pun, fast track this.
From where to where?
I think it was 480 miles from, it started just near, I think 60 miles west of Bangkok, going through up into the highlands, through Thailand, through Burma. And the idea was to be able to get Japanese soldiers and Japanese supplies quickly towards as they pushed towards India, as I previously mentioned, and it was brutal. Basically, a line drawn across the map through the jungle. They used elephants. One of the fine details I liked that elephants did a lot of the hauling of when they cut down the big trees and hauled them away. The Australians liked the fact that the elephants had been there because they left big elephant pats behind them, which were softer on their feet. Things were that grim. And they did the Australians. There were 180,000 workers there, and I think it was 6,000 Australian POWs. The term used at the time was, certainly not used anymore, but coolies, which were Southeast Asian workers who were brutalised to do it. The Australians were particularly busy on building bridges and the infamous Hellfire Pass in a system called Hammer and Tap. And so they get Ma and Fitzsimons, big black Fitzsimons. Yeah. I'll take the sledgehammer, Ma.
Delicate.
You take the bolt, the chisel, and I'm going to belt it using the plum hammer, the weight to belt it down. And then as I lift it up, you turn it a bit. I belt it again. We drill into the rock. Then we put some gelignite in. We blow it. And then all the others come in, pick up the shards of rock. They throw it into the culvert. They build the bridges. One of my favourite details, the Tasmanians, the Tassie men, the Bushies. The Australians did indeed build the bridges, but the Tassie bushmen would go out into the jungle, find huge white ants that they knew would do the job, and they left them in the crevices of the bridge, and they all fell down. A lot of them started falling down by 44, 45. It was finished. Well, the Australian section started to join up in August of 43, but by that point, the Allies' planes were starting to dominate and they started to bomb them. And as I say, the termites did their work, the white ants.
There's a horrifying detail there where you point out that for some of these sections, it would have been much better to tunnel.
Yes.
But the problem with tunnelling was
that you had to go from one end, or you can only work from two ends at a time. Whereas when you go from the top, it's linear construction, so they can all go down.
You can be digging an immense ditch.
Yes,
and
all at the one time. And the worst of it came, and again, I think I've said to you, my favourite story is, but my dinkum favourite story of the whole thing. Cholera hits in June of 43. So the monsoon is howling. The fecal matter has got into the water supply. And if you or I got cholera, they had to put a name tag on us immediately, because in 4 hours we would be unrecognizable for the fact that our body had expelled every bit of fluid in it. And Weary established a tent hospital, which was called Cholera Gulch, about 100 yards from the rest of the camp where the Australians were. And they noticed after the Australians, a South Australian by the name of Bob Fox, an old carpenter, the only way to keep men alive was to get saline solution into their veins. So they got a 44-gallon drum. They had a roaring fire under it. They got tubes from an abandoned Japanese lorry to collect the steam, which went through vats of cold water in the bamboo, comes out the other end. They've got added salt to it. The only way to get it into their veins is to, from a bamboo, sharpened bamboo point, cannula, you jam it into their veins, and it was very painful. And Weary, against all odds, is keeping these men alive. And by the end of June, there's 20 at a time. They've got the roaring fires 50 yards away. So when somebody dies, we don't want the cholera to get back in the water supply. We've got to turn them to ashes quickly. And the 40-year-olds, Weary noticed, they all noticed, somehow tended to survive longer for a more mature approach or whatever. And it was the young ones that were dropping like flies. And when there was 20 people there and they didn't have enough cannulas and somebody was just about to die, Weary would give the nod, put them over there in the corner. And this fellow called Scotty, he was 42 years old. He had three kids from Melbourne, loved his wife. And Weary's looking at him and says, well, he hasn't got long, gives the nod, put him over there on the table. And Scotty says, I know what you're doing, you bastards. You're wasting your time. I'm going to live. Anyway, they put him over there. Meantime, this other fellow, Bob Campbell, 21 years old and had married 4 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon in Melbourne. At 7 p.m. that night, he's on the troop ship. He gets to Singapore just in time for it to fall. He gets to the Tyburna Railway. He gets cholera. He's dying. They keep putting the cannula in his veins and he keeps pulling it out. And Weary, meantime, Scotty has lived after 12 hours, bring him back inside. Weary gives the nod again 12 hours later to take him back outside. Again, Scotty says, I know what you, I told you, I'm going to live. And they take him outside. Bob Campbell, meantime, is deteriorating and he keeps pulling the cannula out of his veins. Finally, Weary decides, I've got to shock this bloke with the consequences. If he keeps doing what he's doing, he's going to die. And Weary yells at him, Men have risked their lives for you to get to set this up. Men are dying for want of what we're putting in your veins. If you do this again, you will not only die like a yellow rat, you will deserve to die like a yellow rat. And Bob Campbell looks at Weary and he says, I want to be with Mum. And Weary, oh, and Weary says to him, that's all right. Lie back. You will be with your mother shortly. And he dies off in the distance for the third time. Scotty is heard to say, I told you bastards, I'm going to live. And he did. And he got back to Melbourne and he lived. I love that story. Except for the Bob part about Bob dying. I don't like that part.
Yeah, that's a bad part. And the voices, which we could have worked on if we had more time before we began to record. This is ABC Radio National. It's Late Night Live. I'm David Meyer. Peter, this is something that hasn't got much to do with Weary Dunlop, but are you puzzled that we are days away from the 50th anniversary of November the 11th, 1975? Now, you've done the hard yards in the Republican movement for years and years and years. Are you surprised that there is not a whiff in the air?
Of outrage.
No, not that so much, of focused outrage. Mm. There's not a whiff in the air that, come on, now is the time to get rid of the monarchy.
Yeah.
Not a whiff.
Well, there's more a whiff this week than there was 3 weeks ago. Prince Andrew, if he was a paid operative of the Australian Republic movement.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
I take it back. I think that's changed things. I think, look, the absolute ludicrousness of, I interviewed the fellow Andrew Lowney that did the book on the Dutch fall of the rise and fall of the Yorks, the Duke and Duchess of York, the House of York. And I said to him, isn't the Andrew Mountbatten stuff emblematic of the fact that the whole monarchist shtick, which is that these people are better than the rest of us with their blue blood, it is blown apart by this family.
But Peter, look, Shakespeare had a go at this story. Mm. I mean, the squalor of the sexual relations of the royal family of Britain and other royal families we've known for ages. But we are about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of an event whereby...
Commemorate,
you're right. Mm. Whereby a vain representative of the crown sacked an elected government.
Mm.
And the man who is now king wrote a letter to
Outrageous.
Kerr. Outrageous. Wrote a letter to Kerr.
Commending him.
Commending him for what he had done and counselling him not to despair too much that the people of Australia were a bit upset about this. This man is now our king.
Yes.
And yet there is not a whiff in the air that this is a time that we might consider getting rid of him.
Yes, and there's not a hunger for it. But can I suggest the things that should start? Can we get King Charles off our coins? Can we get them off our notes? Can we do bit by bit that kind of thing and build up to it? Who knows what will happen if the Prime Minister, who is a Republican, if he wins another term? I think it's fair to say after the results of The Voice, the Labor government a little gun shy of going into another referendum soon. But the younger generation, I take a lot of heart with them because they look at this whole monarchistic nonsense and go, call it for what it is. It is nonsense. It's embarrassing for Australia. One last thing on Gough. I said to Gough in 1992, I was trying to get an interview with him. It took me a couple of years, but he said no. And I said to Gough, I talked about Sir Garfield Barwick, of course, who had given the advice to Kerr that it was okay to, you could sack him. So I said to Gough, Mr. Whitlam, look, if I can't do an interview with you immediately, perhaps I could just have a lunch, you, me, and Sir Garfield Barwick. And Gough replied, that would be all right, comrade, but you're going to need a very, very long table.
control room, can you cut this man's microphone off, please? Just cut it off at this point. Yes, I've been talking to Peter Fitzsimons, who has a new book out, and it's a life of...
Weary Dunlop, the courageous life of Weary Dunlop. Thank you for having me, David Meyer. You barely let me get a word in edgeways.
Get out of here. And that's the show, the week, and almost the year. My thanks to the team, producers Catherine Zengerer, Ali Benton, and Alex Tai, and executive producer Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.